How do a people and a country move ahead into a new sense of identity if the past is forgotten? Whatever South Africa's future, it flows, like it or not, from its history, from its stories. And that future will be strengthened when one considers that history, when one considers how a people, against all odds, maintained identity and strength in the face of astonishing odds, in the face of a police state that divided people rigorously on the basis of skin color. Everything that South Africa is to become in this new millennium is tied tightly to its history, to its survival of 350 years of apartheid.
That's Harold Choi reading from the preface to The Uncoiling Python, his most recent study of storytelling in Southern Africa. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Harold Shoaib is a legend on the UW-Madison campus for his work for many decades studying the oral tradition in southern Africa. He has walked 6,000 miles along the southeastern coast of Africa, collecting 9,500 tales, poems, and histories during a time of tremendous political upheaval. He has completed a 3-volume work on South African storytellers and performances, including Story, The Poem in the Story, and Shadows, and he's currently at work on The Uncoiling Python, Storytelling in Southern Africa. Harold Shoaib is the F.U. Bascom Professor of Humanities and of African Languages and Literature at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air, Harold.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I have to ask then, why South Africa? I seem to recall something about you and the military and a connection there. Is that true or false?
Well, that really goes back. I had spent 2 years in Uganda teaching, and the connection with the Air Force, I'd been in the Air Force for 4 years and never got to travel as much as I would like. I was supposed to go to Korea, and on the eve of my departure to Korea as a jet mechanic, the Panmunjom hearings came along and everything was put on hold. So I never got to travel as much as I would like. So after I did my BA and MA, I took a break, as many people do, and the opportunity of going to East Africa came along. It was in the early 1960s. The British had not done a very good job of preparing the people for independence, so they wanted 150 American teachers and 150 British teachers to teach in the high schools of Uganda, Kenya, and what was then Tanganyika. So I leapt at the chance, and I went to Uganda and taught for 2 years, and it was just an absolute life-changing experience. And since my special interest at university was, I was interested in the oral traditions, I was an English major, I was studying Beowulf and that sort of thing. And I learned how really rich the school kids used to take me home to meet their parents during vacations. And I learned how really rich the oral tradition in Africa is. So I decided when I get back to the United States after 2 years in Uganda that I would shift from English, my major from English literature to African literature, which brought me to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which had the only degree-granting Department of African Languages and Literature in the country. And I wanted to go back to Uganda initially because I knew the country so well. But by that time, Idi Amin had become the dictator of the country.
Notorious dictator.
And the State Department was not allowing Americans to go. This happened early enough so that I was able to shift my interests and my language abilities, and I studied Xhosa, my first African language here at the University of Wisconsin, with one of Africa's greatest writers, A.C. Jordan, who was a political exile from apartheid South Africa. So I learned the language from him. 2 years I studied with him. And then I went to South Africa, and pretty much on my own. I had no guidance once I was there. I did what a grad student was supposed to do. I touched base with all the universities in South Africa, and all the experts told me that I was too late. There was no oral tradition in South Africa. But, of course, they were totally wrong, as they were about so many other things about South Africa. And the oral tradition was very, very rich. But I had no guidance. I just started walking, and I never used a car. Sometimes I caught a bus up into the mountains. Once I remember getting a lift with some missionaries. But most of the time, I simply set out walking. Everything that I owned was in my pack on my back. I carried my tape recorder. The bane of my existence was size D flashlight batteries. My tape recorder took 5 of them. And on a good day, I would use 5 up. And so I always had friends in Johannesburg sending me alkaline batteries to little villages ahead of me so that I would have enough batteries to work with. But it was a an absolutely magnificent experience. I was very nervous about going to apartheid South Africa to do research, but in the event, it was, for me, life-changing, and it taught me enormously about the oral tradition, the richness and sophistication of the oral tradition, and how important the oral tradition was in the history of South Africa.
How did you gain the trust of the people that you needed to get the stories from?
Well, and it wasn't always easy, because no matter how remote I—and I worked in the really remote areas of southeastern Africa, and no matter how remote I got, everybody, it seems, would have had at least a member of their family, if not they themselves, would have had an unhappy experience with apartheid, whether in the cities or wherever. And so the idea of racial separation was so ingrained that along comes this white guy, and he's trying to get himself invited to some of the most important and, in many respects, sacred traditions of the people. And initially, they were reticent about doing this. And in South Africa, the people do not live in villages, so the homesteads are scattered over the countryside. And so if one family said no, then I simply would have to walk. And it was, fortunately, in one of the most beautiful areas of Africa. It was mountainous as we moved down to the Indian Ocean. I walked barefoot much of the time. And so even if somebody wasn't going to invite me to storytelling, the countryside was glorious. But, you know, after a while, I was just persistent trying to get myself invited. And I think that a lot of people decided, first of all, I was not a South African. That was in my favor. I was the most vulnerable person on earth. I had no car. I was simply walking by myself, no translators, no interpreters, all by myself. And, most important, I was seriously, intensely interested in these traditions. And people started inviting me, and it took a while. Every new area I would move into, I'd have to go through the same thing. But, you know, the second time I went back, 2 years later, it was like old home week. I had passed into the folklore myself. I had from then on, there were no difficulties whatsoever. I knew enough people. I had enough connections throughout the area that it was really a homecoming kind of a thing each time.
This was in the 60s.
I started in the late 1960s and then continued every 2 years. It was pretty much in the 70s. And so the basic collection that I made, I returned to these areas quite a bit afterwards through the late 70s and into the 80s. But the basic collection was made in the late 60s and in the first half of the 70s.
How do you think that experience of yours would compare if you were to do it today?
It would be very different. First of all, the oral traditions are not what they were. They're still there. And they're still rich. But another thing that I learned very early on was that the purpose of these oral traditions, and that may differ from today. Today, it's a free South Africa. And so it's a very different atmosphere in South Africa. And so the oral traditions are still important, and they still play that enormously important role. But it was not, at the time I went there, you know, it was life or death. I mean, it was enormously important to the people. Here's the interesting thing. There were Africans who were revolutionaries and who were fighting with guns, with weapons, in Johannesburg, even in the areas I was working in some cases. But the wonderful thing that I learned was that these storytellers, most of them women, most of them elderly, not all, that they were the frontline soldiers in the battle against apartheid. This is what I learned. Yes, there's no question at all that there were anti-apartheid guerrillas throughout Southern Africa, and they were the ones that caught the headlines. These people, you know, I remember A.C. Jordan telling about how he worked in the education system of South Africa. He was black, and he had to go to the various African schools, and he always had two white people with him to make sure he behaved himself and didn't say, you know, revolutionary type things. And he told stories. And the whites were bored with this, you know, just these tedious old stories, and had no idea what he was doing. And generally, the whites had no idea what this hundreds upon hundreds of people. You have to keep in mind that in South Africa, there were no professional storytellers. Everybody was a storyteller. And among them, some of them were magnificent. Most of them were, you know, everyday storytellers. But they were all involved in this struggle.
So do you mean there was like a subtext to the stories?
Yes. A subtext, yes, in a really complicated way. I went to Johannesburg, to Soweto, Southwest Township, the huge, at that time, I think 4 million Africans lived there, African so-called township, 15 miles outside Johannesburg. Africans not allowed to live in the cities overnight. They would work in the cities, and then they would be hauled back to places like Soweto at night. And Soweto was a swarm with young revolutionaries. And I got to know a number of them. And at one point, they were interested in what I was doing, so I played some of my stories to them. And they were contemptuous of these stories. Where, they said, in these stories are the, you know, are the themes of apartheid? Where is the anti-apartheid? And it wasn't there. And I remember going back and talking to the storytellers, and to a person, they told me in words like this, how do you think we have survived 350 years of apartheid? They said it's the truths that are embodied in these stories that have helped us to go through this period. And so they had no apologies for these ancient stories. But of course, never ancient, because the ancient stories in all oral traditions are constantly being tied to the contemporary world. So the ancient traditions and the contemporary world came together. Yeah, they never mentioned apartheid. Well, some of them did, but by and large, they didn't. And so the stories seem to be innocuous, you know, nothing dangerous about this. Just to give you an idea of this, I was in Umtata, the capital of the Transkei, which was one of these so-called Bantu homeland areas that the government created to keep the rest of the world from criticizing them for not allowing Africans to vote. You know, these were set-up type places. And I was present at the opening of the parliament there as African parliament, and the government from Pretoria sent two white representatives of the government down to witness the opening and so forth. And I was standing outside with a large group of people, and one of the whites came out, and he stood there. And as he stood there, a bard, a Xhosa bard, a poet, Imbongi, started singing a praise song to him. And so the white man took off his hat and stood there. And all these hundreds of Africans around me, and everybody understood what was happening except the white man. And the guy was taking the white government to pieces in the story, in the poem. And the audience was very calm and appreciative of it, but you know, knowing how to behave in the presence of this white person. But the bards did this regularly. They created poems about leaders, and in creating these poems, they injected themes of apartheid. So in the poetry, apartheid is very woven in a very clear kind of a way, open kind of a way, but not in the stories. In the stories, you get, they would say, hey, these are simply once upon a time type stories. You know, they're totally unimportant. You know, and the idea for many of the whites was that these are stories that these simple, primitive people tell, not realizing that they were not dealing with simple, primitive people at all, but they were dealing with a highly sophisticated people who were participating in a very complicated oral tradition that was keeping the society and themselves alive and giving them, you know, some kind of hope in what was essentially a hopeless situation. If you were in South Africa in the late 1960s, it was impossible to believe that by 1990, freedom would come to South Africa. It was unbelievable. It was a few years after the Sharpeville massacre. It was a few years before the 1976 uprising, which I attended in Johannesburg. And so you got the sense that South Africa would be mired in this racist system forever. It just, there seemed to be no end to it. So that sense of hopelessness pervaded. And young people who would go to Johannesburg to work in the diamond fields or in Kimberley and in Johannesburg to work in the mine, gold mines and so forth, and they would come back with really desolate stories of life in the urban areas, and life in the rural areas wasn't much better. I remember one of my favorite storytellers telling me about how her husband had died, and he had once worked for the government, so he was to get a $14 a year retirement allowance. And his wife was meant to get that at his death. And the white government refused to give it to her, if you can believe that they would engage in this kind of thing, because she wasn't old enough. And she couldn't prove her age. She had no birth certificate. So she had to go to the white magistrate in a village not far from where she lived. And she still remembered when she told me this story. In Xhosa society, a woman wore head scarves that were really elaborate, and she never would take, it was tradition, that she would never remove this headpiece in the presence of somebody who was a man who was not her husband. But this magistrate decreed that she had to take her hat off in his presence, something that she did not want to do. But she did, and the stereotype among whites was that an African woman was not old until her hair really turned gray, and he decreed that her hair wasn't gray enough and that therefore she could not have the $14 a year. And she told me, he can have that $14. She said, if I was starving, I would never go back and put myself through this. So this is on a normal everyday occasion, but of course we know that the situation of blacks and whites in South Africa was often much more deadly than that.
How would a story like that come out in an oral tradition?
Now, in the oral tradition, she would never say these kinds of things. You know, what the oral tradition was it was composed of these ancient stories with these old motifs that are as old as time itself. A storyteller, a good storyteller, would have a repertory of these motifs. There were certain stories from the past, and the storyteller would know these and would create them around these motifs. So the storyteller would recreate a story about, you know, somebody who's moving through a rite of passage, for example. And then, as always happens in stories, stories are never memorized. It can't be, because there has to be this electric interaction between the past and the present. So what the storyteller would do is take the ancient story and weave it into contemporary images. Not contemporary images that had to do with apartheid, necessarily, but contemporary images that had to do with life in a farming area, but a contemporary kind of a thing. And so the storyteller would take the ancient images, link them to the images of the present, and so create a story. And in that way, what would happen is the storyteller would use images that were known to every member of the audience. This was enormously important. The members of the audience know these everyday images. And then, with these magical images of storytelling from the past, would weld them into a story. And in welding them into that story, would create themes, ideas, symbols that were as old as the society itself and wove the present society into the ancient traditions of the society. And so the ancient traditions continued to have their influence on the present, and the present echoed back to the past. And it was in this way, the storytellers said, that they were able to survive. I mean, this was their roots. This is what keeps us alive, they said. This is what keeps us strong. This is us, they said. And they argued that this is something that the government, a white government, could never take away from them. I mean, this is the word, the spoken word. This is the memory and the emotions that are invoked by the memory and the images of the present. And so for them, it didn't have to wave flags, anti-apartheid kinds of flags or anything like that. And it didn't even come close to that. Some of them did, but by and large, they didn't. And this really fascinated me. Before I went to South Africa, there were two really important works that have been, I think they're classics. And in fact, some people, some great writers, have said that these books are among the greatest books ever written. One of them was in 1868 by put together by a British missionary whose name was Henry Callaway. And what he did was he went throughout in Zululand, did what I did later, 100 years later, and that is collected oral traditions. And in this collection of oral tradition, it's magnificent. He was very careful, a very cautious scholar. He would have English on the one side and the original Zulu on the other side of the page. And among the storytellers that he worked with was, from my point of view, the greatest storyteller not only in South Africa, I think, that Africa has produced. And her name was Lydia Umkasitemba. So she didn't even have an identity. She was given a Christian name, Lydia. And her last name, Umkasitemba, means the wife of Setemba. So she herself was this, in effect, faceless person. She told 8 stories, and they are glorious stories. I did a book about her and a storyteller I worked with in Zululand 100 years later, some years ago. And in preparation for this, I scoured the archives and libraries of South Africa, trying to find whatever I could about Lydia Umkasitemba. And I was able to find a little bit about her husband, who was a Christian convert, so Callaway wrote a little bit about him, but nothing about this glorious woman. And one of the things I'm very proud of as somebody who's interested in storytelling is I've been among those who have kept her alive, this woman who was buried in the years, 1868, and yet who was absolutely magnificent. And the other book is 1911, a book called Bushman Folklore by some German philologists, W.H.I. Bleak and Lucy Lloyd. And the very title of the book, of course, tells us a lot. I mean, these were the San people, S-A-N, the San people of South Africa. They were vilified, called Bushmen, a derogatory term that was given to them by the West. And this is the book that many people think is one of the great books of all time. And it's a collection of San stories, poems, with, again, the San language on one side and English on the other side. But once again, here, the people who are looked upon as not even human. If you look at some of the old 1700s books written by Dutch travelers in South Africa, you can see drawings of the Dutch settlers shooting guns at the San people because the San people were not considered fully human. They had the San, one of the most glorious oral traditions and one of the most magnificent religions that we know of. And so here in these ancient San poems were these poems about the uncoiling python. And that image of the uncoiling python, which among the San people meant loyalty, meant unity, meant coolness in the face of adversity. And in fact, it was the Xhosa people who intermarried with the San people. That uncoiling python image became transplanted to their poetry as well. So when I talk about the uncoiling python, I'm talking about people who would not be diminished. The San people were almost destroyed. The Khoi, another people who were there at the same time, the so-called Hottentots, were destroyed by the whites in South Africa. The San people were forced out of South Africa into the Kalahari Desert, and the whites having absolutely no concern for them as human beings. And yet, they had these traditions that kept them alive. And so it kept them alive during these early years of the white presence in South Africa. And then when apartheid really moved into full gear, the stories among the Xhosa, the Zulu, the Swati also became very important.
We'll look closer at collecting stories, the oral tradition in Southern Africa, in just a moment. This is University of the Year.
Kwati kekalokun gansomi. So the storyteller would then begin the story.
That's Harold Scheub giving a little sample of Xhosa, one of the languages he studied as part of his work on the oral tradition in Southern Africa. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking about the uncoiling python storytelling in Southern Africa. I'm curious because you said you studied for 2 years the language before going there, and as you're traveling and walking these 6,000 miles and collecting storytelling, did you run into some moments where you had no idea what was being said? And I would think also translating would be so difficult.
Yes.
When I hear you do the clicks, for example, I'm wondering how that would translate into English.
Well, I remember the first time I was in the Transkei among the people who are called the Mpondamise people. And the first time I heard a story in Xhosa, I thought I had learned the wrong language. It just washed over me like a flood because I had been studying a literary form of the language. And as you know, oral and literary forms can be very different. There were all kinds of people who were ready to help me to be my translators and interpreters. And I decided, no, if I'm really to come to terms with these stories, I'm going to have to understand them. So it took me a little while to sort of start flowing and not my mind not grabbing at every word, but starting to flow with the language. And then after a time, I really became more and more comfortable. But I remember when I moved from the Xhosa up to the Zulu, and I had internalized the Zulu vocabulary and a grammar. But when I was having trouble, I would revert to Xhosa because I was more familiar with it. And they're in the same language family, the Nguni language family. But people gave me a really rough time. You have to keep in mind that the areas I worked in, nobody spoke English. I mean, there might be a couple of words that people brought back from the mines and so forth. But by and large, people did not speak English. So I was on my own. I mean, I really had to contend with the languages or I wasn't going to make any kind of, if I even just asking for directions and things like this. So what I did was I had to convince myself, first of all, that you don't have to be a 5-year-old to learn a language. And then I studied Xhosa, as I said, for 2 years here, and then worked on it when I was there. And then I did the mastering of the vocabulary and the grammar for Zulu, then Swati, and then in the southern part of Zimbabwe among the Ndebele people. And it always took me a little while, and it was very uncomfortable at times. But the people were just wonderful to me. You know, if I made a mistake, they might laugh at me, but just let me give you an example. I was going to work in the lower reaches of the Drakensberg Mountains among the Xhosa, and that's one of the times when I did get a lift. Two missionaries, two men, gave me a lift up into the mountains because it was a long distance, and I got out of the car and started walking, and I was met by two Xhosa women, and they said, "Where did you come from?" And what I wanted to say in Xhosa was I got a ride with some missionaries. And what I actually said was I rode some missionaries and learned very, very quickly that the word ride has sexual connotations in Xhosa. So from then on, whenever I came back, it was always, hey, here comes a guy who rides missionaries. So I made all kinds of blunders as I was learning the language. Look, I remember that in some places people would say, yeah, you can come to our storytelling session, but you will have to tell a story from your own tradition. And I still remember the first time I ever told Jack and the Beanstalk in Xhosa. And it was a total disaster. And again, the people laughed, but then they gathered around and taught me. It was the best thing that could ever have happened. They were teaching. And in fact, you know, all that I know about storytelling, about how stories communicate meaning and so forth, I learned from the storytellers. They taught me. We would sit down afterwards, often with the audiences, sometimes not with the audiences, and talk about the stories that had been created. And, you know, I can still remember once I was heard a story among the Zulu. After it was over, I was feeling very full of myself, and so I started to wax heroic about the meaning of that story. And midway in my peroration, the storyteller stopped me and said, wait a minute, she said. "If I'm to explain to you what my story means," she said, "I have to tell my story all over again." For her, it was not possible to come to the end of the story and Aesop's fable-like tell the audience what it means. For her, and for my experience was for all the storytellers that I met, the meaning of the story is in the totality of the story. And so it's impossible to sort of, it would be like, you know, taking an ode by Keats and summing it up in two sentences.
Yeah, the cliff notes, spark notes.
That sort of thing. Yeah. Or as Leopold Sédar Senghor, who was the poet president of Senegal, once said, a poet, he might as well have been saying storyteller, knows how. He said, look, when a scientist wants to understand what makes a bird fly, they take the bird apart, and in the end they're left with a bunch of bones and feathers. He said, a poet becomes one with the bird, soars with the bird, and thereby understands the bird. And this is the storyteller. So you can't take all what the storyteller says and take it all apart, and in the end you're left with all these bits and pieces. You have to really understand how that story works, the rhythm of, you know, as with all works of art, the rhythm of the story.
Boy, but that would preclude, what, 80% of English teachers and
exactly.
English college professors explicating things away.
My students get sick of hearing me say this, that, you know, you have to understand the whole thing. They, too, you know, want to find all these lessons in the thing. And these lessons may be there, but that's not what the story is all about. And, you know, the story is about connections, relationships within the story. The thing that defines story is metaphor in its most complicated kind of a sense, because a storyteller is creating something in the contemporary world, something in the ancient world, and it's up to the audience to find the connections in between. That's, you know, that's what great art is. Great art demands that we do the work, that the author doesn't do it for us. And that's the case with painting, with sculpture, I think it's the case with movies, whatever it is. What the storyteller does is the storyteller enlists our emotions. And through enlisting our emotions, makes us part of what's going on. It's not just one of these, my life is like a red, red rose kind of a metaphor. I mean, we're engaged in that. We're a part of the metaphorical experience. So a great storyteller will, right from the start, will elicit these emotional responses from the audience. And then slowly work us into what's going on. And we love it. What we do is we give our emotions to the storyteller. When the storyteller says, "Kwati kekalogun gansomi," we are ready for it. And we belong to the storyteller. And the storyteller can take our emotions and do what the storyteller wants with them.
If we take the idea you had that contained within these stories might be a protest against apartheid or some sort of a stirring up things or a message, could you give an example of how you might take, for example, animals and represent the different races or somehow get some kind of emotion across?
A.C. Jordan once told me this story. He's a black man, an African, South African, going around with these whites who are keeping an eye on him as he's talking to all these teachers. This is a simple example, but it'll answer your question, I think. He told the story about how all the birds of the earth came together, and they were going to decide who was the greatest bird of them all. And among the greatest of the birds was this huge white hawk. And this huge white hawk was going to soar the highest into the heavens. So all the birds soared into the heavens, and chief among them is this white hawk. And a hawk goes higher and higher and higher, leaving all of these other birds behind. And in the end, he reaches the apex. And just before he is to begin his descent, from out of his feathers comes a tiny little black bird, and it goes flying a foot ahead of the white hawk and then descends with the white hawk. And so, you know, of course, the audience immediately understood what he was saying. But my experience with storytelling is that it wasn't as obvious as the story I just told. You know, it really has to do with human beings who live in worlds that are, you know, dangerous. And we have all the dangerous, you know, storytellers have a whole arsenal of dangerous ogres and swallowing monsters and all the rest of it. I mean, there are tons of these kinds of things. So you tell a story about a boy or a girl moving into manhood or womanhood. And as this child becomes an adult, as this child moves through this change, the child will have all of these experiences, dangerous experiences, deadly experiences. But the child is able to master them all and move out in the end. Again, a simple kind of a version of what happens in these stories. Stories often deal with rites of passage, with a person moving from one state of being into another state of being, whether it be puberty rite of passage or marriage rite of passage, any kind of change in life. And these changes in life are very difficult and really scary. We know they're scary. You know, when young people go through the puberty rite of passage, it's a frightening experience in their lives. And so these stories are meant to prepare a person for these changes. What happens when these simple little, seemingly simple little puberty rite of passage stories become a part of the ammunition that people use to help an entire people move through not just the puberty rite of passage, but an enormous change, 350 years. I mean, that is incredible. And a people who, you know, who lost hope during this time, there were many. But the storytellers kept this thing going. Simple little stories, at least on their surface, at least this is what the observers insisted, and yet they were enormously potent stories.
What do you lose when you write them down, translation notwithstanding?
Huge problem. I've done a lot of translation, and it's enormous. I long since have understood that when you translate stories into the written word, you're going to lose the body of the storyteller, you're going to lose the tone of the voice, you're going to lose that electric relationship with the members of the audience. But I also know that, you know, there are literary storytellers who have been writing forever, and they are able to do this with unseen audiences. My feeling is that the really great stories that I collected, I've done meat and potatoes kinds of translations of them. But one day, maybe a poet will come along and really do justice to these stories. But yeah, I think that what I can do in translating them is I can identify the various parts of the story. I can certainly keep the story alive as it moves through the various parts of the story. But the poetry of the story, that relationship with the audience, no, I don't kid myself that I'm capable of that.
And if these stories are constantly being updated and connected to the present time, are your stories dated in a way?
Here's the interesting thing. Sure. Always. The minute a story is told, it's dated. And I worked on this. I was really interested in what happens when a storyteller told a story 1 year, and I came back 2 years later, worked with the same storyteller, and heard a version of the same story. But it was a version. You know, it's never the same thing because, as I said, there's no memory here, no memorizing. As the contemporary world changes, so the stories change. Stories are alive. They're not meant. Your question is enormously important. They are not meant to be frozen in time. They're alive. And this is why this wonderful Lydia Umkase Temba, her stories are frozen in 1868. And again, I've collected the storyteller I worked with 100 years later. Her stories, same stories, but very, very different. But even my experience is that even in print, stories like Lydia Umkase Temba, storytellers like her, she continues to soar. Even in that form where we have no body of this woman, we have none of the atmosphere of the story. And Calloway was not the most poetic translator on earth, but he was very true to the original Zulu. But even so, even through that, something extraordinary emerges, I think. The greatest storyteller I worked with, her name was Nonginile Masitatu Zenani Akosa. And I did a collection of her stories called The World and the Word. And my English translations were passable. You know, they're okay, but they were not Masitatu Zenani. But fortunately, I have at least her voice on tapes, and I took hundreds of slides of her, motion pictures of her, black and white photographs of her. So I've tried to document it to the extent that it's possible. But I don't kid myself. You know, the original performance is gone. It's there, you have it, and then it's gone. It's like, you know, seeing a great piece of theater.
Or jazz, or something jazz. Improvised
Absolutely.
Music.
You have it for a moment, and you're lucky to be there to hear this magnificent piece. And it'll never be the same thing. Yeah, I used to go down. Yeah, that's a good point. I used to go down to the Blue Note when there was a Blue Note. I don't think it's still there in Chicago. And heard all of the great, you know, in the golden years of jazz. And we would come out of that place at night fully knowing that we had had an extraordinary experience that could never be duplicated.
Right.
No, it's gone. And even if it's put on recordings, it's there, but it's not like that original experience. And so, yeah, I taped these. I tried as much as I could to document them, but the moment passed. And the moment was very important. You could see what it did to the audience, how it unified the audience. We're talking about sophisticated people who were drawn in by stories, you know, so that it wasn't something, that a cast-off kind of a thing for kids. It was something for adults as well.
Did you ever feel like throwing down your tape recorder and joining the revolution? I mean, as you're witnessing some of the horrible aspects of apartheid, did you ever kind of feel like crossing over to the other side?
I absolutely cannot begin to tell you about my own emotions. Why was I here? I mean, how could I be here in a country like this? On the other hand, I thought I'm very happy that I was there and that I was able to document some of this. When I went in June of 1976, I was working in the remote area of Southern Africa, and some revolutionary friends of mine from Soweto came down in their car to pick me up because the government kept an eye on me. And so
I'm sure they did.
And so I played around with my documentation of what I was doing, but I was gone for several days. And in my journal, I was still, you know, in the remote area of Southern Africa. They told me that something extraordinary was going to happen. And so I went. I was in Johannesburg. I was in Soweto just before it happened. But then I was out of Soweto when these are high school kids who felt that they were going to do something that their parents should have done. And they were going to go into the streets to protest apartheid. The ostensible reason was that the government had decreed that African children had to learn Afrikaans, the Dutch language, in the schools. And the children, they used that as a pretext. They were not about to learn the language of the oppressor, being forced to learn that. So I saw the beginning of this as these young kids, no weapons, some of them had sticks, marching down the streets with banners and so forth, opposed to apartheid and opposed to what was happening in South Africa. And it caught fire all over South Africa. Young kids, we're talking high school kids, went out into the streets. And during that year, 1,000 of them would be killed by the police. Many of them were put in concentration camps and never heard of again. They simply disappeared. But it was one of those electric events in South African history. Caught the attention of the world. And for me, along with the Sharpeville massacre in the early 60s, the 1976 uprising in Soweto and elsewhere in South Africa, and then in 1995, where it was virtually open revolution. It wasn't labeled revolution, but South Africa became impossible to govern. So that when F.W. de Klerk decided that they were going to, late in 1990, they were going to allow a certain amount of freedom. What they didn't realize, of course, was that they were opening Pandora's box. I mean, once the lid was open, there was no stopping it. They had taken Nelson Mandela out of, he was in jail for life. He had been in jail for 27 years. And they put him into a car late at night and drove him at various, they knew that he was going to be a leader when change came to South Africa. And he had been out of contact with South Africa for 27 years. And so they took him around Cape Town and other places to show him the changes that had taken place. Yeah, by that time, South Africa was ungovernable. So from 1961 on, I suppose looking in retrospect, you could say that you could see the end, but not when I was there. It was just such a hopeless kind of a thing. And I visited as many homes as I could in the rural areas as well as in the urban areas. I went to braaiplaces, you know, these barbecues held by Dutch people. I wanted to hear what they had to say. I really wanted to understand the mentality of a people who were oppressing a whole people. And, of course, as we learned in Germany during the Holocaust, these people were like your next-door neighbor. You know, they were everyday human beings, and yet they were capable of doing something like this.
Some final thoughts about collecting stories, the oral tradition in Southern Africa at a very formative time, the 1960s and 70s, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Get involved with Wisconsin culture, arts, humanities, and history by visiting portalwisconsin.org from the Cultural Coalition of Wisconsin, including WPR. Learn something new or just have fun at portalwisconsin.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest for the next few minutes is Harold Scheub, indefatigable collector, gatherer, translator of African stories from Southern Africa in particular, and most recently the author of The Uncoiling Python. And you mentioned, Harold, that that is an image that is particularly important in Southern Africa. Do you have some specific places where you find that in the written literature, too?
I do. These are from the 1800s. For example, here's a poem. The person who rises late has seen nothing because he has not seen the python uncoil.
Huh.
And another, come out, people of the palace. You have seen nothing because you have not seen the python uncoil. I collected this poem from a man named Magagamela Koko, who created this poem for his son. He said, I will praise again my senior son. Children, walk in shoes. Some are only beginning to sit. Some are only starting to work. Some are only learning to speak. The late riser has not seen anything. He has not seen the python uncoil. My feeling is there's an underlying warning here, in these poems. And this uncoiling python image is all over the place, especially in the poetry.
But it almost seems that it's an image you don't want to see. In other words, why would you want to see a python uncoil if it means it's about to attack you?
Beware.
So you're saying that this is an image of facing life's dangers?
Or? Yes, well, or who the late riser is. The late riser has foolishly seen nothing because he will never see the python uncoil.
But doesn't that mean he'll be safe?
No. I think it's a dangerous kind of a thing.
It means the python is uncoiling and he just doesn't see it coming?
Yeah, and my feeling is that the uncoiling python is a warning to the whites that they weren't aware of the force of these people. The idea that, yes, the people were being diminished, the people were being enslaved in many respects, but there was something there that they didn't see, that there was something in those people that was keeping them alive. Again, yeah, it doesn't mean that the people were, it was a call to arms or anything like that. It was the idea that there is something here that keeps us alive, and beware of that. You know, that we're not being overwhelmed, overcome by you.
And that uncoiling python, again, it represents unity.
Loyalty and coolness. There's an interesting comment about the Zulu. The person wrote, the Zulu are convinced that the python is the coolest of all the animals in the world, a result of the coolness of water, especially of deep pools. And there is the coolness related to calmness and an even temperament. A python is said to have no careless, haphazard action. All right? And another person said, this animal is never seen working hastily or in anger. It is always slow and steady, thinking a long time before it does something. That is why we say it is cool. It's a symbol of great power expressed in physical strength and ability. Okay? Here's the thing. When I heard these poems, my question was, isn't this at odds with, after all, the people who are comparing themselves to the pythons are being put down. You know, they're being subdued. And one person told me that, look, it's true that they have the power and so forth. But there's something in us that will not be put down, they said. And this is the uncoiling python.
You know, I'm reminded of the American Revolution and the snake imagery. You remember that famous image, join or die, of the disjointed snake, each segment representing one of the colonies. And then, of course, the famous motto, don't tread on me.
Yes. I heard it a lot in the poetry, and so I raised a lot of questions about it. And the people to whom I spoke, inevitably, the uncoiling python was the Africans, in the face of enormous difficulty. It's always there, and it's going to survive.
Tremendous power and power of just waiting to be unleashed.
Yes, and the can power.
Can I ask you, with your study of African storytelling, what you found? You know, you started with Beowulf. You've mentioned Jack and the Beanstalk and other things. What did you find in those 9,500 tales and stories and poems and histories that you collected that's uniquely African, other than the sort of geographical references or specific to that place and time? Is there anything uniquely African about the way of telling it?
Certainly uniquely African in taking the traditional stories, the traditional motifs that we find in stories all over the world, but clothing it in the garb of Africa, of Southern Africa. And as you say, the contemporary images are always rooted in the real, the contemporary world. But here's the thing, that if you took one of these stories and told it in India, I don't think the people there would have any difficulty understanding it at all. They may miss the contemporary references, but the story itself of a person moving through a change, a transformation, these are universal. So here's the thing, these stories are at the same time both universal and very, very particular. And this is the power of storytelling, is that we human beings, and this unites us, I think, to the Africans, that we tell the same stories, but the stories also have their own uniqueness. And an everyday storyteller may only be able to communicate the universal part of it, but a great storyteller is able to link it to the contemporary world. And that linkage, that connection to the world that we know, is what this uncoiling python part of our discussion is all about. That it's this that kept the people alive. So they had the universal, and the universal is forever. And that is very hopeful. And they tied that. They made my life at this point in history a part of that universal. And I think that was a very important thing. I think people know these stories inside out. They've heard them a million times. What they were interested in, and this is why you had people who have heard these stories often in every audience, because of what this particular storyteller was going to do. The linkage, always the linkage, the connective. That was the important thing.
Story collector Harold Scheub and storyteller extraordinaire Harold Scheub has been our guest for this hour. The clicks alone worth the price of admission.
And there's a whole collection the UW Memorial Library is doing of the films and the stories and the slides that Harold Scheub has collected over the years.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.